Chapter 5. Lysander. Games. Shrill whistles pipe from a shimmering mirage as the wild sunbloods gallop out of the desert. The surviving youths of Mercury's ruling elite pursue the white horses, herding them in a ritual stampede toward the storm gates of Heliopolis. The horses pour through the triumphal arch erected to honor my victory over the rising and into the streets of the city itself. The horrific burn scar Darrow's boot left on my face itches like mad. Truly, it'd be easier to be rid of the thing, but a scar from Darrow is a point of honor and a good reminder of what he's done to our society whenever I look in the mirror and see the wrinkled, shiny horror that makes my eyelid droop. I resist scratching it. There are eyes on me. From my place atop the triumphal arch with Glorastes and Roan to either side, I nod to a blue. With a warble from the gravity engines, the arch rises. We follow the horses as they press deeper into the city, their hooves rattling the surface of the Via Triumphia. Behind barricades, the morning crowd is already drunk on spiced clove wine from Carrick's and cactus brandy from Polyobos. Despite the Herculean efforts of our sanitation divisions, radiation from the atomics used in the Battle of the Ladon still infests the continent. The radiation has made many of the citizens grow bald. In defiance of this pestilence of baldness, they boast wigs of eccentric length and color. And they remember well that it was Atalantia who sowed this radiation, not Darrow. In the eyes of Mercury, Darrow and Atalantia are equally loathed, but I am beloved. Pouring money into a planet will do that. They chant my name. Behind me, my Praetorians stare down at them like a row of militarized falcons. My whisper, Kyber, crouches to the left. My last line of personal defense, the discreet Looney's Grey, follows me everywhere. Today she plays a copper. Her sensitive jaguar-mod eyes rove the rooftops from behind chrome goggles. "They love you like children love their father," Glorastes says. Wind whips my cape behind me and tugs at Glorastes' brilliant orange robes. Roan grimaces. "If only love wasn't so expensive. If only all those voices belonged to soldiers." "These people are the heart of the society," Glorastes calls over the wind and the clamour. He shields his eyes from the sun to look south of the city to the spaceport. There, the Lightbringer, beset by swarms of construction skiffs, looms like a mountain. "It's the thump of military boots and the buzz of welders that is the music of insolvency." "Better to be impoverished and strong than impoverished and popular," Roan replies. Though he cuts a fine figure in his purple and silver parade uniform, Roan is no parade soldier. A veteran's veteran, he's fought on 13 spheres, and wears the evidence in the phalera on his chest and the scars on his face. He is no blunt object. A violent intellectual, he was Arja's favourite grey, and he is now the clever engine of my growing military machine.
"Mobs may seem strong as the sea, but give me a star shell and a Moses I will be."
Glorastes sharpens a retort. "If you can't get along, silence is preferable," I snap, annoyed at their mutual and growing enmity. "You're both heroes of the people, so wave your gory hands and lobby me later." I wave to the people below. Block by block, the crowd grows denser and more drunk. Sunburnt women in wigs shout down from the rooftops. Children climb their father's shoulders to wave the flag of their favourite racing team. The gold and white of Team Hermes dominates the main boulevards as the sunbloods flow south, past the bazaar, through the partially restored water gardens, where the stampede completes a circuit and then turns gradually toward the Hippodrome, our destination. At the grand building, my arch settles down over the entrance to the executive reception plaza. We disembark between two columns of Praetorians. In the lift to the executive level, Glorastes physically side-checks Roan to take his place at my side. Roan is so surprised that by the time he regains his balance, the doors to the elevator are already closing. I hold up a hand and signal him to meet us up top. The grav lift ascends.
I don't know if force is the right idea with Roan, I say.
How else can I penetrate the purple and black wall that follows you everywhere but with my hips and wits?
Glerastis glares at Kyber, who stands in the corner. Somehow she was already in the lift waiting for us.
But one always manages to slither in.
You have something to say, go on and say it.
Glerastis, the greatest architect of his generation, is bald, hawkish, with heavy eyebrows, gleaming orange eyes, and a stooped, predatory posture that once made him seem hungry and unctuous, but also impervious to any drug or construction catastrophe known to man. More and more, though, the posture also betrays his fragility. He seems like a man teetering over a cliff. These past months have been hard on him. In the end, artists are a sensitive breed.
There are rumours the Saud denied you a loan. Is it true? He asks.
I sigh.
You know what I miss most about being assumed dead? No gossip.
Roan is steering you to ruin, he blurts out.
Glerastis, old friend, these games were your idea, I say. The people need hope, you said.
The games are a pittance compared to what you're spending on ships and legions. And it's not the game so much as the guests who trouble me.
You dirty your hands dealing with the likes of Roth and the Carthii?
A tired line.
But I should cover myself in eagle shit. Hardly a fair comparison. You're bleeding money. Lady Bellona is distinguished. Far more than just a banker or a brute. She is a broker of power. She might not control the 200, but she influences a sizable block of senators, most of whom have no love for Atalantia.
Yes, and perhaps if you sang my praises in her ear, she might actually have deigned to attend my games, I say. Instead, she sends no note, no emissary, just her racing team. It's been nothing but insults since she sent Roan to aid me in the desert.
Perhaps she did not sponsor you to be Atalantia's plaything, he says.
Would a plaything smuggle legions to the Minotaur? I ask.
Now you'll moan I am reckless.
You're juggling asps, my boy. Forget Bellona money. If Atalantia...
Hades, if the Carthii discover you and the Minotaur have a secret pact...
He glances at Kyber.
I don't understand, Lysander. Why him? The Minotaur is an insane person. He craves the ephemeral, experiences, satiation of his lusts. No man is more your inverse, and yet you waste the wealth that could rebuild Mercury to send him an army.
Lysander, I am scared. For you, for me, of every shadow, every glass of wine.
Maybe you should quit drinking then, I say.
I apologize immediately when I see the pain on his face.
Glerastis, you have no reason to be afraid. I will protect you, I promise.
But honestly, what would you have me do? I'd have you listen to the people. You are loved, so be loved. Do not play Atalantia's game. Play your own. Abandon this pursuit of an army and a fleet. Focus your time and money here. Let Mercury's prosperity be your campaign for the morning chair.
He reaches to grasp my right hand.
It would break my heart to see you get caught in a gold knife fight. You're better than that.
You must be.
Maybe I am. But without power, everything else is just good intentions. Now, I have guests waiting.
Glerastis pouts, but does not protest when I reactivate the lift. Pytha waits on the executive level with Roan. Roan's grav boots shimmer with heat from his ascent.
Sorry, I must have tripped, he says to me, with a glance for Glerastis.
Glerastis doesn't follow me out of the lift.
You go on, he says. I haven't the stomach for your guests or guards today.
Annoyed, I leave Glerastis behind. Pytha, the blue pilot who watched over me for so many of my formative years on the Archimedes, raises an eyebrow. You want me to fly him home?
You'll miss the race, I say.
Please. Chariots?
They don't even have engines.
Python chose to follow me instead of Cassius. That loyalty and her belief in my vision for the society has more than earned her the post that will make her the envy of all blues in the society, Captain of the Lightbringer. That is, if the ship actually flies. Otherwise she'll be a laughingstock, and me with her. Our fates are entwined. I thank her and head for the box with Roan.
"Vodka on his breath, and it's not even known," Roan says. "I thought Mercurians were supposed to be industrious."
"Mind your own self, Flavinius. I'll not have you sniping at each other. Now put on a smile for my guest," I snap, and plunge into the pulvinar.
The girls drinking inside the suite raise their eyebrows at Pytha and Roan. They shift away altogether from Kyber, thinking her a copper because of her disguise. But Roan is popular. His service record, if not the myriad teardrops on his face, would demand respect from even Atalantia. I greet my guests with alacrity and mannered courtesy, until a roar a few minutes later draws me beyond the protection of the silk awning and into the sunlight. In the stands below, low colours rush up through the tunnels from the vendors toward their seats, arms laden with fennel sausages, candied pecans, oysters, and sloshing gourds of wine. To the 250,000 who cram together on the tiered marble bleachers, the sound of the hooves on the street outside is still distant, but already the crowd hollers in anticipation. The voice of the hippodrome gargles like infant thunder.
Only when the first wild sunblood enters the stadium does the discordant noise coalesce into a single voice.
"Ad Astra! Ad Astra! Ad Astra!"
The horses pour into the racing sands. The youths gallop after them, herding the horses into running a lap. Great flames light around the stadium to signal the beginning of the games. As the dust-caked youths pass the pulvinar, my box, they stand in their stirrups to salute me and my peerless guests. The youths resemble dusty birds of prey. Their faces and eyes are severe, their bones still thin, but though not one is over 15, there is not a trace of youth left in them. I have seen that look before. It is the look of having already chosen one's fate. It worries me to see it in those so young. I wonder if I wore such a look when I sat by Calendora's deathbed as she succumbed to the poison on Darrow's blade and confessed her part in the assassination of my mother and father. An assassination planned and executed by my mother's best friend and my betrothed, Atalantia. Considering Darrow has no reputation for poisons, it's not hard to guess who was really responsible for Calendora's demise.
"Less than 300 graduates. A pittance compared to Atalantia's institutes," Roan drawls, surveying the young horsemen and horsewomen. While most of my guests remain reclining in the shade deep within the box's air-conditioned recesses, Roan sweats with me in the early morning sun.
"Dominus, what I said about Glorastes wasn't wrong, but I won't have Glorastes defamed, ever. I look over so he sees how much I mean it. You were not informing me. You are playing politics. Now, let us move on."
He nods and goes back to business.
"Our spies on Venus report Carthii institutes are churning out young peerless," he says.
"The Saud are not too far behind. Still, if you ask me, you chose the right colour to invest in."
He eyes the thick band of greys that claim the front rows around the racing sands. I agree and scan the promenade level in distaste. Although Atalantia is occupied solidifying her hold on Earth and laying siege to Luna, little escapes her gaze, even less her taxes. Her gold allies, and there are many, populate nearly half the boxes on the promenade level. The boxes were to be sold at auction to help finance these costly games. Instead, Atalantia helped me spiral toward bankruptcy by insisting none of her friends be required to pay.
"Ravenous lot, aren't they?" a voice murmurs.
I turn to see a slender, deeply tanned woman of middling height.
Horatia Alvotum, Cicero's younger sister, is not a warrior despite the peerless scar on her heart-shaped face. A master administrator, her narrow eyes shimmer only for numbers. She's far more at home amidst a coterie of coppers than she is on a warship or battlefield. They've not come for the games, they've come to see us fail. She means they've all come to see the Lightbringer launch, or rather, not launch. As the project manager in charge of refurbishing Darrow's crashed ship, she takes that personally. More liberal and political than Cicero, Horatio has assumed her father's place of prominence amongst the reformer bloc in the 200. Our politics are strikingly similar, but hardly popular. We pray we're not naive for believing that's only because the tyrants of Atalantia's iron bloc have the lion's share of war prestige and military might. The wine you'll buy for these girls alone would buy armor for half a legion, to say nothing of the food.
Or pinks, I reply.
Or violets.
They're not our worst guests, I think, Rowan says.
No. Horatio's not over-fond of smiles, but she graces Rowan with one.
So which guest of honor holds that claim, Roth or Carthiae? The Venusians, always. With a sour look, Rowan glances behind us at the brood of House Carthiae, lounging in my box, drunk on my wine. I'd rather have hosted the Rim deputation, especially their rising hero, Diomedes. But Consul Dido's reply to my invitation was a single line, Mars must fall. So, instead of honourable, worthy, peerless Knights of the Rim, I'm beset by Carthiae Philistines so cultured they've forsaken the use of manners. Horatia leans in. I've done some reconnoitering with my friends on Earth. The Carthiae are, as you said they'd be, unofficially unaffiliated. The furious Atalantia let Roth keep their dockyards.
So available.
I wouldn't say that.
Available, I confirm.
In Atalantia's decade of war and her lifelong quest to claim the sovereign's chair, she has relied most on the Carthiae shipbuilders of Venus. That has changed. After Apollonius stole the Carthiae dockyards, Atalantia alienated her old allies when she signed the détente with Apollonius to ensure his stolen Carthiae ships keep flowing to her armada. All rather messy. I, of course, was only too happy to broker the deal. While politically conservative, opposed to reform, and generally insidious, the Carthiae are powerful and very wealthy. Winning them would be a political and military coup, but also as safe as bedding a viper. I smile when I spy the best mark of those Carthiae present, meaning the richest and most ambitious of the lot, sizing me up from amidst a clutch of her brothers. Barely 27. Valeria Alcarthiae, like many of the ruthless young girls of her generation, has found war to have a catalyzing effect on her prospects.
She has ascended past many of her more famous brothers to become a third-place contender in the expansive and often fatal sibling rivalry to become their ancient father's heir. With her father, Asmodeus, well past 100 years old and still replacing lost progeny like it's funny, she is likely in need of a powerful new friend. I nod to her. She tips her glass my way. Bottom first. A slight Venusian flirtation.
"Where's your brother?" asks Horatia.
"Cicero," she frowns.
"Even I can't track that variable. I'll inquire at the groom's." "He promised me he wouldn't race."
"I'll inquire with the groom's."
Valeria Alcarthiae sways toward us before Horatia can leave.
"Lysander, I've just looked at the programme, and I must say it's terribly Aurelian of you not to include the gladiatorial matches."
She slurps the flesh from an oyster and discards the shell on the floor for the servants.
"Or are you to blame, Horatia?" "I fear it's a collective statement," Horatia says. "Excuse me."
"Reformers? Ugh.
Such prudes. Valeria wrinkles her nose.
Chariot races and Pegasus chariots are all well and good, but truly, what are the stakes if no one's dying?
I think the people of Heliopolis have seen enough death, I reply. At a nod from me, Roan slips back under the awning to keep watch on me from the shade opposite Kyber. Valeria watches after him.
Shouldn't let your dog sit at the table, Lysander. They'll eat the food off your plate.
Praetorians are hardly dogs. Falcons, perhaps. She chuckles.
I hear Horatia is responsible for that delusion of grandeur to the south.
She is, I reply. It was her idea to use the wreckage of the White Fleet to repair the Lightbringer.
Votum's building ships. If I thought that possible, I'd be offended. It looks like a monster, far too heavy in the front, not even painted.
Horatia says paint is a luxury our budget can't afford.
Hilarious woman. So serious.
Valeria says,
Are you fucking her? Or is it her brother you like? Both?
Like I said, we're not on Venus today, I reply.
Mm-hmm.
Her eyes glide to Roan, then down to the Praetorians in the stands.
I heard you were a student of our ancient ancestors, a virtuous shepherd of the people.
She busies herself shucking and slurping oysters.
Still, we all wonder when you'll grow tired of this orgy of Equitas and come join the real circus.
I'd like nothing more than to join the war, but without a military appointment from the Dictator or the 200, I must tend my duties here on Mercury. The last thing I want to do is meddle in politics.
What a law-abiding young citizen you are,
she smiles.
Imagine my father's relief when he learns that you don't consider lobbying Atalantia to exploit our stolen docks to be meddling in politics, she says.
The Battle of Mercury cost us dearly, and Julii and Augustus are putting up a rather impressive fight, I say. The war requires warships to replace our recent losses, no? That your family lost your dockyards to a madman and a handful of soldiers is hardly my fault. Actually, it's more an indictment of how your father treats his workers and citizens. I hear your own people rallied to Apollonius and helped him take the station.
I merely helped Atalantia and Apollonius remain focused on the greater interest of our people, winning the war.
She rolls her eyes.
Lysander the Lightbringer. Lysander the Peacemaker. A maker of peace wouldn't keep that scar. Hideous. Does Atalantia like it?
No, she detests it.
I love it. Savage. From Darrow's own boot, now.
She eyes the burn on my face and sucks down another oyster.
I'm a simple woman. I like ships. Flying them, building them, taking them from my enemy and painting my centaur on them. I do the eyes myself, then have a cigar. What do you like, and don't say peace?
Power, I reply, and look up as a thunder rumbles from above. Against a blue sky, huge obsidians, painted white, beat their drums on each of the Hippodrome's 14 towers. The main gates open, and the chariots of the four-horse Grand Prix emerge one by one. An announcer declares each rider and their team, sending each team's supporters into convulsions. After all, what else makes peace?
This isn't power. This is theatre, she replies. Expensive theatre. The love of the people won't buy you the morning chair, Loon.
But it affords me the opportunity to ask what would. She grins.
You know what I want, Peacemaker? That which the Minotaur stole. That which Atalantia was only too ready to trade away. That which my father withholds and my siblings covet. My inheritance.
Really? I had no idea. Stop. Our politics are
opposed, she says.
Reformers are in denial of humanity's basic lowness.
But we have much in common, you and I. Atalantia and her father gobbled up all those loon ships and fortresses and men, and then slapped the grimmest skull onto them.
Has she returned what belongs to you?
I smile. Everyone knows she hasn't, even though by law she should.
It seems we've both had our inheritance stolen by a usurper. If only there was a way to help one another.
Her eyes drift to the box to the right of ours, where Apollonius's brother, Tharsis O'Rath, parties with all his race-day finery, surrounded by his cadre of new sycophants, exiled Martian ghouls, lithe courtesans, preening poets. Wraths did not exist at the time of the conquering, so no matter the vastness of their wealth, the depths of their infamy, or the quality of their wine, to their everlasting chagrin, they've never been considered a premier gens.
I fear your inheritance is already spoken for,
as is mine, I say.
For now.
She smiles.
For now?
Tharsis seems to glow as he feels our eyes on him. I've sworn him to keep public distance from me, lest others suspect I am in league with his brother. I must maintain the appearance of neutrality. He prances to the edge of the box, just a few paces off. He shouts,
"Either you want to fornicate with me or kill me. I don't know which, Valeria. The first would be fine, but the second is improbable, if not impossible."
He idly probes a passing pink.
"I am immune to glares, knives, and all between, for my brother has atomics pointed at your inheritance, and he is..."
He gestures to one of his drunker sycophants.
"Mad as a bull!"
the friend cries, and makes horns with his fingers.
The rest make bull sounds and dance around before breaking down into laughter and blowing kisses at the Carthii.
Horatia returns with news of Cicero.
"He didn't," I say, reading her expression. "Tell me he's not."
"He did. He is,"
she says. Apologetic.
I wince, and the crowd roars as the announcer proclaims the entrance of the reigning champion of the individual circuit. Riding as always for Team Hermes, Cicero Avotum drives his chariot out onto the sands, his four-horse team led by the indomitable Blood of Empire. Wearing a white tunic with leather straps tightly bound to protect his chest, Cicero's powerful arms and legs are tan and oiled. Like all charioteers in the classic pre, he is woefully under-protected. My blood boils at the sight of him riding with a smile toward mortal jeopardy.
"He promised he wouldn't race," I mutter.
"Stakes, after all," Valeria says in delight.
I sigh. "Pardon me. Theatre calls."
"For now?" she asks.
"For now," I reply. "But not forever." She toasts to that. I signal Flavinius before jumping over the wall of the Pulvinar to land below, where Kyber is already waiting. She really does look like a copper Actarius with her datapad and lithe limbs. If she has a weapon on her, I can't see it. Shocked by my descent into the common stands, the crowd cheers as I make my way amongst the mid-colours, not to sit with my own men, but to honour the Votum legions. Cicero's greys receive me with the hero's welcome Rome paid their centurions for. As I place my bet with the roving bookie, Cicero guides his chariot past and lifts his hand in formal salute to me. His voice, aided by some unseen microphone, booms out across the arena.
"I dedicate this race to the saviour of Heliopolis, the steward of Mercury, the image of Selenius, last of his line, Lysander, the light-bringer."
He blows me a kiss. Cicero guides his chariot to the starting line, and the crowd roars. Silence falls. The charioteers fix their eyes forward, and when the long, mournful note bursts from a great white horn, the chariots lurch forward, and the sands swirl.